just can't make it. You cast a spell on me, and I just can't break it. Got your love on my back, child, and I just can't shake it. If you don't help me, baby, I know I can't make it. Cause I'm suffering from a heartache.
Suffering from a heartache.
CITR 101.9 FM. This is the Inkstead Show, the radio show where we talk about what, Colin?
Comics, graphic novels, manga.
There we go. Actually, I never talk about manga. I don't like manga. You should know that.
I'm not going to get into this at the moment.
Get a spine. Who was that we just listened to? I don't even remember what it was. Chains of Love by who? You got you there, Scott?
Oh, yeah, you do. Sorry.
Yeah. Hello?
It's the Dirt Bombs.
There we go, the Dirt Bombs.
The Detroit garage rock band, the Dirt Bombs.
See, garage. Colin's like, this is sold. Like, this
no,
is not
I changed
soul.
My mind. I changed my mind.
Yeah. CITR 101.9 FM. This is the Inkstead Show, the reader show where we talk about comics. Today's guest is Scott Chandler, and his book is the Annotated Northwest Passage. And today is going to be an extra special Canadian day. All month I've been doing a focus on Canadian cartoonists and comics. And last week we had David Collier on, and we've had many, many other fine Canadian talents. And this week is kind of neat because it's actually a book. I mean, Dave's stuff is about Canadian history too, and really. But this is, you don't get much more Canadian than fur hunting. You really don't. And so this should be an interesting show because Colin, my co-host, is a, amateur scholar of Canadian history, thanked by Chester Brown and Louis Riel for his knowledge of military uniforms. And his father was a professor in Canadian history at the school where Inkstuds is broadcast out of UBC. Where I am currently majoring in history.
My father taught about pre-contact East Coast First Nations and the United Empire Loyalists. So.
And his work is, he's actually got a lot of acclaim for his passionate writing on the Mi'kmaq and Beothuk.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
Passionate.
Passionate. No, actually.
Passionate writing.
One of my teachers at one of the colleges I went to, Langara, she said he was actually quite known for his really like passionate look at these cultures that a lot of other scholars at the time weren't really focused so much on finding out who these people were, but it was more of that kind of new world philosophy. Oh, this is, you know, the First Nations history isn't important. Looking more at the English history, while he's focusing on these people that were already there. So,
right on.
And Beothuk, a lot of lost history. This is something we can say.
A very sad story.
Yeah. died out in 18... No, where is it?
Well, more like hunted to extinction.
Yeah. Hunted and diseased.
You know, I can barely hear Colin.
Yeah.
Hello? Hello? Is that
I can hear him just enough to know that he's talking, but I really can't hear a word he's saying.
Okay. Try now, Colin.
Hi. Is that better?
Okay, the mic was on backwards.
Scott, hello? Hi, how's it going?
You're yelling into it now, Colin.
Oh, sorry.
There we go. Okay. That should be... Is that good?
That's good.
That's good. Okay. So, let's get back on focus here. Your book, The Northwest Passage. You have a whole walk of other stuff, but the big one for us is The Northwest Passage.
So yeah, right on.
Tell us about The Northwest Passage.
Well, it's a graphic novel about an English fur trading post, a fictional English fur trading post, but it's sort of loosely based on York Factory in 1755, which is taken over by French privateers, the leader of whom is an old enemy of the chief English trader. And basically the English traders have to band together and try to retake the fort from the French mercenaries. So it's good old-fashioned, two-fisted, bare-knuckled men fighting each other in the woods kind of stuff. Classic adventure.
It is.
As I say.
So how much research went into putting this together?
There was a lot of research. I'm not a scholar like yourself, but I am interested in Canadian history. And I actually got the first... I got the original idea to do the story, and I mentioned this in the annotations in the book, maybe 6-7 years ago now, when I first read Peter C. Newman's books, Company of Adventurers and Caesars of the Wilderness, which are the first two books in his History of the Hudson's Bay Company. And when I was reading it, I just thought, here is an amazing setting for an adventure story, and one that is largely untapped, at least in comics.
Mm-hmm.
And I really didn't at that time have any, illusions that anyone would publish such a comic. at the time I was having trouble getting any career in comics going at all, but I certainly wasn't pitching history stuff because people were saying, we can't sell history comics. So it wasn't until years later after I'd done a few books for Oni Press, I happened to mention on their website, I've got this idea for a, Canadian frontier Western. Isn't that hilarious? And I got an email from Jamie Rich, who was then the editor-in-chief, literally 2 minutes later saying, we've been looking for a Western, but we want an unconventional one, so pitch us this. So yeah, it was. I wasn't even thinking about realistically doing this project until it was sort of dragged out of me.
So
and Chester Brown hadn't done his Louis Riel book yet. That came out. Well, the collected version, the graphic novel version, came out when I was about halfway through writing Northwest Passage. So that sort of gave me some hope, actually, that there was maybe an audience for material this far off the beaten path. But yeah, until then, I just thought the book I was writing was going to be an abject failure. You know what I mean?
So even though you were dealing with an American publisher, they didn't have any concerns about the setting or the fact that it was Canadian history?
No, not really. The guys at Oni just really like offbeat material.
They like yarns.
I told them... when I was having the conversation with Jamie Rich about it, I said, I've never even bothered pitching this because, it's Canadian. And he said, well, pitch it and just don't mention the word Canada. You know what I mean? So that's what I did. And, that worked. I just, like in the 50s pulps and stuff, I just kind of referred to it as the Northwest or the Frozen North or, some sort of euphemism for... some country north of the United States.
Well, of course, there wasn't a Canada yet, so it's perfectly
right.
Perfectly proper.
Yes, It's early pre-Canada, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
It was a wonderful time to be a fur hunter.
It was indeed.
Fur trapper.
Yes.
Fur trader, whatever.
Well, the majority of the characters are actually traders, aren't they, at this point?
That's the Hudson's Bay at that time waited for the Indians to bring the furs to them.
Or the Métis.
Or the Métis, unlike the French and the Nor'westerners who would actually go out. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm geeking out already.
That's okay. All right. That's all right. Come on, Colin.
Is that right?
That's what we do here.
That's correct, isn't it, Scott?
Yeah. In fact, I make reference in the book to the fact that this is during the point in the Hudson's Bay Company's history where they had given up exploration altogether, which really rubs the main character in the book the wrong way. And the Hudson's Bay Company, like Colin says, was mostly just set up in trading posts along the bay where the natives would bring them the fur, trade them for, you know, muskets or fish hooks or blankets or whatever they needed, and then, you know, head off into the wilderness again for the winter. So the baymen at that time were mostly just traders. And then every year the ship would come and take the furs back to England, and all the shareholders in England would get rich.
Pretty much. Now, what was the choice of making the villain French?
It just seemed,
because it kind of, you know, we're Canadian and there's that French English split in some aspects.
There is. I mean, it's the classic rivalry in our country, right? And very much in the time period. I mean, York Factory, which is the fort that my fictional Fort Newcastle in the book is based on. York Factory traded hands between the English and French, I can't remember how many times, but it's 6 or 7 times over its history. I mean, there was a lot of conflict between England and France over controlling the furs in North America. I mean, it seems ridiculous to even think about now, but there was a lot of money in furs. So like I say, those forts, especially the bigger forts like York Factory, would find themselves in some violent conflict occasionally. Because England sort of had the monopoly, and the French wanted to get it, you know, mm-hmm. for sure.
Well, so this is the point when it was the Rupert's land that was basically the land was quote unquote owned.
Right.
By who was it?
The Hudson's Bay Company.
Yeah. Now, was this pre-merger or post-merger, Hudson's Bay and the other fur company?
Oh.
This is pre-merger.
The Northwesters and the Hudson's Bay, I think they merged sometime in the 1830s.
Yeah, that sounds right. Mm. In the book, there is a band of private traders. The leader of whom is one of Charles Lord is the main character. He's the governor of the fort, and one of his old exploring buddies, one of his men from the old days, has broken away and is doing some private trading on his own. So I've tried to kind of depict what became the Northwest Company.
Mm-hmm.
The Northwest Company was very much made up of all these sort of independent traders, these outlaw independent traders who eventually banded together. And together, because they weren't afraid to go into the interior and do the exploring, they really started cutting into the Hudson's Bay Company's monopoly.
Well, and there's also a difference in the distribution, because the Northwest, they would travel along the lakes.
Right.
And so they would actually be year-round, wouldn't it? The Hudson's Bay would only be able to come when the ice was thawed.
Right.
The Nor'westerners, their trade was mostly through Montreal.
Yeah.
Yeah, they had to, you know, because England ran the Hudson's Bay Company and it had the monopoly, the Nor'westers had to go into the interior and then all the way back to Montreal every year to sell their furs.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a hell of a trip, as you can imagine.
Going from basically roughly Winnipeg to Montreal.
Yep, and deeper all the time. I mean, they were always trying to go in further and, you know, further than the Hudson's Bay Company, you know, could penetrate and all that stuff. So a lot of the West actually got explored by by these fur traders who were just trying to one-up each other.
Mm-hmm. And they're mostly English, Scots, French Canadians, Métis, First Nations people?
Yeah, I think a lot of Scottish.
Yeah, a lot more Scottish, less English.
Yeah.
I actually just did a course in early Canadian history previous semester, and it's all nice. Out of my brain now, so unfortunately I can't name the
different
groups.
I wish I had taken a course like that. You know, once I started doing these types of books, I was like, oh, I should have studied more history. You know what I mean?
There's so much to learn.
There really is.
One thing I was kind of curious about was the whole Northwest Passage. Were they still looking for the Northwest Passage in 1755? I mean, I thought the Northwest Passage was the idea of an open or a river route from either side of the continent, and hadn't they given up on that idea by then?
They would. It's been years since I did my research when I wrote this book, but my recollection is that it was very much a recurring. You know, the Hudson's Bay had sort of given up on exploration for a while, but then they got back into it, and I think the Northwest Passage was something that explorers at least had in the back of their mind. But there were also some very well-known excursions to go looking for it. So, yeah, up until it was actually found, it was sort of the holy grail of North American exploration, for sure.
So that's the route over the top of Canada and in the Arctic waters?
Yeah.
Around Alaska.
I think I'm sure they were hoping it wouldn't be a route that was quite so far around.
Or full of ice.
Yeah. Like when Henry Hudson, for instance, found Hudson's Bay, he thought he'd sailed into the Pacific. He thought he'd done it.
Oh, wow.
And then, you know, when he got to the bottom and he started heading north again, he started, you know, crapping his pants. It's like, oh, man. This isn't it at all. This is just a really damn big bay.
So,
you know,
at least he got it named after him.
Yeah.
So, but 1755, had the Spanish or Cook reached the Pacific coast by then?
Oh, don't ask me.
Oh,
yeah. I probably could have told you 4 years ago when I was up to my neck in research on this, but I don't think I could tell you now.
So are you planning to do more on the Northwest Passage, the characters in the series?
I am, but I don't have any specific plans at the moment. I get this question a lot, especially since that hardcover collection that came out last year has been pretty popular. I mean, I always intended that as the first story of several, but it's by no means meant to be a regular thing. It's something I'll just sort of go back to throughout my career, and I've got so much else on my plate right now that I can't possibly go. I know what happens next, pretty much, but I can't do it because I've got so much else going on.
Because there's some really important events coming up, the French Indian Wars, the fall of Quebec, but would your story deal with any of that because it's so far east?
It's the Seven Years' War is going to be vitally important to the series.
Mm.
This first book takes place just as the Seven Years' War is about to begin.
Well, yeah, and they're talking about how they got to be careful about the boat,
right?
In case, you know.
So I've sort of planted some seeds there, and you know, as more Northwest stories, as more Northwest Passage stories happen, the war that's going on will become increasingly important.
I have to thank you for one thing.
Okay.
Not requesting Stan Rogers.
I wouldn't have done that.
I'm so disappointed.
Colin started.
That's just a little too on the nose, isn't it? I mean, it's.
When I geek out on Canadian history, I'm totally committed.
You'd have gone all the way. You'd have gone with the.
I would have gone with it. You know, songs about privateers.
Yeah, I think if I'd have picked a song that had the same title as one of my books, it would just be that's just crass.
Unless you name your book after a song title that was specifically awesome. But yeah, I'm Canadian. I've grown up with CBC radio, and I heard far too much Stan Rogers growing up. And for those of you Americans who are listening, be glad you did not grow up with Stan Rogers. Maybe Wikipedia him or something.
Sure.
CBC probably has a Stan Rogers page.
I'm sure they do.
They've got stuff for all sorts of local small Canadian bands. Speaking of bands, I think it's time for another song.
I think it is.
What would you like to hear?
What do you, man? I can't even remember what I asked you to play.
I got
Charms. Let's go with the Charms.
That was So Romantic.
Yep.
Okay, we'll be right back. CITR 101.9 FM.
Right on.
CITR 101.9 FM. This is the Ink Stud Show. Up next week on August 7th, Canadian month is over. So I'll be talking to more Americans again. Craig Yao will be on to talk about the ARF series in comics as well. It's just been released that he will be putting out a book of fetish comic strips by Joe Shuster. Yeah. And then.
Nice. I didn't even know there was such a thing.
There is. Craig found a stockpile of them in some used bookstore in Britain, apparently.
Nice. Wow.
And August 14th, Mark Vanier will be on to talk about the Kirby book, which is fantastic. Fantastic. I read this. There's this autobio strip in there about when he was a young troublemaker, and it's incredible. I wish he did more autobio stuff.
Before he comes on, you should know that his last name is actually pronounced Evanier.
Evanier.
Just, yeah, I don't want you to make that mistake when he's, you know, there.
I don't want to be too Canadian. Yeah. Thanks. I do that all the time. And August 21st, it's going to be a slew of local guys. I don't have it figured out yet. But it will be a bunch of local Vancouver guys. And 28th, an interview I did just a couple days ago with Mr. Eddie Campbell about his newest book. Don King joined me for that one. Oh. Sorry, Colin. And you've already talked to Eddie Campbell. Don hadn't talked to him yet.
There's no way you can talk to Eddie Campbell too much.
I just want to make sure everyone gets a chance.
Exactly.
There we go.
Eddie Campbell is amazing.
He is. He is. Did you see him in San Diego? You just got back.
Not this year, but the very first year I did San Diego, the first volume in Northwest Passage had just come out, the smaller volumes, the paperback ones.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was sitting there with my books at the Oni booth doing my signing, and I very rarely geek out when I meet comics professionals anymore. I mean, you know, I've met a million of them. But this sort of, you know, white-haired gentleman comes up to the Oni booth and is looking at my stuff, and he seems interested, and he asks me about, you know, how I do my research and all this kind of stuff. And I was doing a sketch or something for somebody, and at some point I looked up and realized I was talking to Eddie Campbell. and you have to understand that From Hell is my favorite comic ever. I think it's just the best that can be done in this medium.
Mm-hmm.
And I just started getting a little shaky and sweaty, you know. Like, you know, I'm talking about drawing historical comics with Eddie Campbell. What do I say? Do I sound like an idiot? You know what I mean? So that was one of my, you know, yeah, that was the first San Diego for me, was chatting about historical comics with Eddie Campbell.
That's a good time to have.
They can trot out all the movie stars they want. Meeting Eddie Campbell was the highlight of that show for me.
I heard this year was pretty overdone for the movie stuff.
You know, it's weird. When you're at the show, you have no idea what's going on at the show. It's so big.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know what's going on at the booth you're at, and that's about it. I have to come home to find out what was announced at the show. You know what I mean? It's so weird. It's so big. It's hard to even get your head around it anymore. But, yeah, it was crazy, as usual.
But you had fun?
I had a lot of fun out there this year. I'm not really looking for work, and I didn't really have anything new to promote other than my run on Hawaiian Dick at Image, which is almost done. And so I just kind of took it easy, you know? I went to the show, and I just did my signing times, and other than that, I just sat by the pool at the hotel or went to the bar or, you know, one or the other. Or maybe the bar at the pool.
That sounds like a good time to me.
Even better.
It's probably hot as hell down there.
Because some years you go down there and you're just run off your feet. I mean, the show itself exhausts you because it's like 100,000 people under one roof. I mean, mm-hmm. it's exhausting just walking from the door to wherever you're signing. But, I mean, on top of that, you know, you've got a bunch of meetings lined up and you've got to see this person and that person and you're, you know, trying to chat up so-and-so for some work, and I just didn't do any of that this year.
Nice.
I just really tried to enjoy it, and I did.
Now, Colin has a couple questions about Northwest Passage, and then we'll get talking about your other work and who you are.
Okay.
Yeah, well, I was just wondering, a couple of, I guess, you know...
One question?
Political correctness questions. Okay. You have this, you know, sort of attractive, dynamic, cartoony style. But Northwest Passage, it's really, there's a lot of violence in it. And have you had any bad reaction from that?
I wouldn't say bad reaction. I mean, my style is sort of designed to be as accessible and as appealing as possible. But there are certain sort of hardcore comics readers who can't get into it. You know what I mean? They just want everyone to draw like Jim Lee, and you know, that's what a dramatic comic looks like.
Huh. I liked him better when he was called Neil Adams.
See, the thing about my style is the way that I get to, the way that I sort of get at the themes that I'm writing about is through the characters, and I think that's how the audience gets at the themes too. So that being the case, I want the characters to be as expressive as they can possibly be. And I just don't think you can do that. I mean, there are a lot of artists I admire who draw very realistically. But for my money, the way to get at the characters is through, like I say, you know, cartooning, through
like exaggerated facial expressions.
Yeah, through caricature, mm-hmm. I guess is basically what I'm saying. I want, you know, And I hate to be this guy who dumps on superhero comics, but a lot of those artists are pretty stiff, and you know, they've got to knock a building over or throw a car to get your attention. You know, I want to do the kind of comics where a raised eyebrow, you know, means something.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And if you've got to, you know, if you've got to exaggerate that eyebrow a bit to call attention to it, then that's what you do. But that's the way I think about my stuff anyway, and I think most people get it. I mean, I think once you've really taken the time to sort of get into one of my books, I think most people end up understanding that.
Mm-hmm.
Some people, like I say, the hardcore capes and tights people are sometimes put off by my work because it looks like, you know, it looks like Disney Adventures or something, you know, is a comment I had on a message board one time. But
really?
But that's what, you know.
Disney's Adventures in Blood.
Yeah. It's just, you know, that's how I get at the characters and by extension the themes. So
I wonder what they think of someone like Kim Deitch.
Who knows?
That looks like a cartoon. Oh, my God.
And I do come from an animation background. I mean, I haven't done a lot of work in animation, but I do have some of the training for that. And it's, I don't know, it's just that certain...
Je ne sais quoi.
I know Disney carries a lot of negative connotations, but the early Disney stuff, I mean, that Disney himself directed,
mm-hmm.
One of the principles of early Disney animation was appeal, and that doesn't mean that every character looked like a fluffy bunny rabbit, but every character had sort of visual hooks that, like I say, tuned you in immediately to who they were and what they were about, and I just think that's important. You know, it's a visual medium, and I think you should almost know who the character is the first panel that he appears.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? It's like I say, it's just how I get at the material.
Yeah.
Oh, and my other question was about how difficult was it to write First Nations characters?
It was kind of difficult. Northwest Passage was the first thing I ever wrote professionally, and I was pretty nervous about it. I didn't really, for a lot of the time, I didn't feel like I knew what the hell I was doing. But that was probably the most challenging thing was, I don't really know a lot about First Nations people and didn't, of all the sort of subjects I had to research, that was the one that I maybe didn't quite research enough. I mean, there are a few Native characters in the story, but they're fairly, you know, they're supporting characters who don't appear all that often. And I think I actually say in the annotations that my, you know, that what I'm writing about Native people is probably informed more by movies than by any actual research. And I really haven't had any complaints, which is good. I mean, I don't think I got it too wrong, but yeah, that's something that if I could go back and do the book again, I'd do a whole lot more reading on that particular subject, because I'm still not entirely confident that I gave First Nations people their due, really.
Well, the Métis were such a central role in the fur trading world.
Yeah.
I think it's one of the main things to keep.
Mm-hmm.
And I, there's a future story I have in mind, and again, I have no idea when I'll get around to this, but that is set entirely in a Cree camp, or at least mostly in that world. And in order to do that, obviously, I will have to really, really do up the research on that particular topic. So I'm actually looking forward to that, you know, when and if I get around to that.
Right. Now, let's talk about your own history. We've talked about Canadian history. Let's talk about Scott Chandler's history.
Let's talk about that.
Tell me about how you got into comics and your own artistic edumacation.
Okay. Like a lot of people, I sort of wanted to get into comics, you know, pretty young. You know, as soon as I was old enough to, you know, notice the credits on the splash page. and you know, realize, hey, there are people who do this for a living. Maybe that's what I'll do when I grow up. I was just coming up though at that time. I graduated from high school in 91, and you know, as we all know, the 90s was not the best time to be looking for a job in comics.
Not if you had integrity.
Well, exactly. And I mean, even if you did, I mean, there were, yeah, there was just, yeah, the bottom dropped out of the whole scene there for a while. So yeah, I mean, I tried, you know, pretty much right from the moment I was out of school to, I did all the stuff you were supposed to do. I sent out samples. I went to conventions with my portfolio and showed it to anyone who would look at it. And it just, you know, I got a couple of really small press, you know, assignments that, you know, paid little or nothing. And, you know, that seemed to be about it. And so I kind of gave up. I kind of got frustrated with the whole scene, you know, as a reader and as a creator. So for a couple of years, I just was not into comics at all. And, you know, I got a career as a commercial illustrator going, and that, you know, I was doing very well at that. But, you know, I wasn't getting that whole storytelling aspect, which is, you know, what comics is, right? I mean, it's not just about drawing pretty pictures. So, I think the year 2000, I started a daily webcomic on my professional website, and I had no illusions about this being the thing that would get me into comics. It was just something I was doing to scratch that particular itch, and just to have something on my website that would update every day and hope that would bring in some people, some hits.
The all elusive hits.
Exactly. And so this is before, I mean, now everybody's got a webcomic, right? But, you know, 6-7 years ago, I mean, virtually no one was doing it. And I hooked up with, at the time there was this website called Toonorama that was run by an artist named Steve Conley. And, you know, it was, you know, 6 or 7 creators who were doing webcomics and sort of, you know, trying to have a sort of a portal where, you know, we could all be found and, you know, people who were trying to do it at sort of a high level. And, yeah, I did that for not very long, maybe just a couple of months, before I sort of burned out doing a daily strip, in color, no less. But, the important thing that came out of it was that one of my readers was, a writer named Jay Torres, who I'm sure a lot of your listeners know, who's a Canadian comic book writer,
in Toronto.
Yeah, in Toronto, and he's, I mean, at the time, he's a lot bigger now, but at the time, he'd done a little bit of writing for Marvel and had the copybook Tales, which was a fairly successful indie book, and, you know, I knew who he was. I mean, I recognized his name. And he started, you know, we started talking about the strip and blah, 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 and he said, look, I've got this graphic novel that I'm pitching to Oni Press, and if they accept it, I want you to draw it. I think you'd be good for it. And, you know, by this time I'd heard a similar thing from so many sort of struggling writers that I just said, you know, sure, sure. you know, call me when you've got a deal. And he did. You know, he placed the book with Oni Press. It was Days Like This, which was my first book. And he called me back a couple months later. He said, I got the deal. You know, let's do it. So all of a sudden I was in comics. You know what I mean? I had stopped trying years ago. I didn't even know Oni Press was a fairly new company at the time. I didn't even know who they were or what they'd done.
Was that when Bob Schreck was still there?
When I got involved with Oni, Bob Schreck had just left, I believe. Because yeah, Jamie Rich was the editor in chief then, which turned out to be really handy because Jamie in the 90s had been the submissions editor at Dark Horse Comics and had been seeing work from me for ages. So when Jay Torres said, yeah, we've got this book and I want Scott Chandler to draw him, Jamie already knew who I was.
Huh.
So, you know, all those years that I was sending all that stuff out and, you know, I'm sure the submissions were terrible, but, you never know when that stuff's going to pay off. You know, it could be years later, you know, someone remembers a submission you sent. So who knows?
I think that's
you think you're going to get into comics one way and you end up sort of coming in a completely different way.
Well, keep that in mind, folks listening.
Exactly.
Working on stuff. It's just keep pushing it and push out there. Yep. You never know who's going to see it.
Yeah. And of course, the first, you know, the first job is always the hardest to get, right? So, you know, after Jay and I did Days Like This, then we pitched Scandalous, and we went right into that. And then while I was working on Scandalous, I pitched Northwest Passage. And then, you know, that's opened up a ton of other doors.
The rest is history.
Yeah, exactly, literally. Ba-dump.
I'm going to play another song, and then we're going to get into your other projects.
Beautiful.
Sound good? So, yep. How about Detroit Cobra? Sound good?
That sounds good to me.
Alrighty, CITR 101.9 FM. This is the Inkstuds. We'll be right back. CITR 101.9 FM. This is Inkstuds. Tell us about your love of garage music, Scott.
I don't know. Nothing just beats good rock and roll. You know what I mean? I like a lot of kinds of music, but good rock and roll is just hard to beat. It's also hard to find, however.
Being Canadian, we are exposed to only the worst. Are you going to defend Kim Mitchell, Colin?
I am not. I would never do that.
There's more to Canadian music than Kim Mitchell.
I know, but you know what? It's what we get exposed to as Canadians, unfortunately.
Nazareth.
I was in high school during the prime Kim Mitchell years.
Ooh.
I feel you there.
Might as well go for a soda. See, Americans, you have it good. You don't know who Kim Mitchell is, and if you do, I feel sorry. And I'm sorry if there's anyone that's listening that likes Kim Mitchell.
Somewhere Kim Mitchell is listening to this and a tear is rolling down his cheek.
A single tear.
It's nothing personal. Nothing personal, Kim Mitchell, but...
I had a big laugh when one of our local suburbs, Surrey, one of the less favorable areas in the lower mainland, they had a Canada Day celebration. Kim Mitchell was the headlining act.
Yikes.
And that's all I have to say. So, yep. Other projects.
Let's just move along from that.
Tech Jansen.
Oh, God.
Well, that's the, I'd say that's probably your most known comics work, isn't it?
Oh, I hope not. I mean, you're probably right, but I hate to think of it that way.
Why the hate, brother?
I shouldn't really, I shouldn't get into this. There's no, any time I talk publicly about the Tech Jansen experience, as I have come to call it, I get a call or an email from somebody, you know, 10 minutes later saying, oh, you shouldn't have said that. So yeah, all I have to say about that is
the comic's been released and people can buy it.
Yes, please go buy Tech Jansen and don't look at that art too hard.
And you never met Stephen Colbert, and
not personally, no.
No, how come you never talk about the comic on the show? That's what I can't figure out. I've never seen him plug it on the show.
No comment.
Okay.
Seriously, I haven't been involved with the book for over a year, and I really don't even know what's going on over there anymore, and I definitely don't care that much.
Tell me about the other projects you were saying earlier. You're very busy with upcoming stuff.
Yeah, I've got a ton of stuff in the works. One is a nonfiction graphic novel that's based on my grandfather's World War II diary.
Wow.
And also the war diaries of his regiment. And so that's been a pretty...
That sounds fantastic.
Yeah. Everyone I tell about that book gets really excited about it. So that's... I've finished writing that and I'm into some art on that. And I've also, on the completely other end of the spectrum, I've got... sort of an all-ages fantasy series coming out from Kids Can Press, who are getting into the graphic novels game like everybody. And that's, I'm sort of working on that at the same time, so it's a busy time. But at some point, just a whole bunch of new Scott Chandler books are going to come out.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that's two generals?
Yeah.
That the one about your... your grandparents' experiences?
My grandfather, yeah.
So tell us about your grandfather. Give us a snippet of who he was.
He was a lieutenant in the Highland Light. The Highland Light Infantry of Canada. And he went overseas in 1943 with his best friend, and the book sort of follows them through some of their training and stuff, and then the HLI went into Normandy on D-Day, and was involved in they went right through the entire war in Europe, but my book ends with the Battle of Buron, which is about a month after D-Day, and is one of the bloodiest battles in Normandy, and which my grandfather was the only officer from his company to survive.
Wow.
Yeah.
Was that one of the battles around Caen?
Yes.
Against the Hitlerjugend?
Yeah, Buron was in that circle of towns that was the inner ring of defenses around Caen.
Oh man!
So they had to punch through there to get at Caen, and it was pretty well defended. The 12th SS was hunkered down there, ooh, like you wouldn't believe.
Yeah, that was a very serious fight.
Yeah.
Now, and the Canadians on D-Day, they took a big hit too. Because they did a lot of
the Highland Light Infantry was in the first wave, but they weren't one of the assault battalions. So they came ashore a little later in the day, which is, you know, probably a good thing, or I probably wouldn't be here. But
a mere 3 hours has created
the Highland Light Infantry actually didn't lose any men on D-Day, but they sure got it a month later at Buron.
The Canadian beach was actually less contested than what the Americans went through at Omaha.
Oh, okay.
So the Canadians actually had the furthest penetration of any Allied force into Normandy on D-Day.
Go Canada.
Yeah. Rah, rah.
We're so patriotic. How is that for you, like, exploring your own family history? How's that been?
It's been... I mean, it's been really interesting. I mean, there's nothing that sort of gets you up in the morning and doing the research and stuff more than having a sort of a personal stake in it.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, on the other side, the sense of responsibility is.
That's what I'm wondering about, is like, because you're taking on something so personal.
Yeah, the sense of responsibility I've tried not to let paralyze me. You know, when I was writing, I just tried to, you know, I tried to kind of put it out of my head that I was writing about a relative, that I just needed to, you know, stay focused on, you know, this is a character and this is a story and you know, I've got to do all the things I would normally do. And just try to, you know... I try to, you know, this is a character named Law Chantler. It's not my grandfather. You know what I mean? You know, if I thought too much about that, then I would just kind of freeze up. You know what I mean?
I read on your blog that you had access to the Highland Light Infantry of Canada, their war records, their war diary.
Yes.
Was that
difficult? Which was great. I mean, I probably couldn't have done the book without that, because my grandfather's diary, which is where the project kind of started, that I would do an adaptation of the diary, I mean, it was great, and it gives a very personal take on the whole thing, but there's so much that's not in the diary, mm-hmm. in terms of details of what they might have been doing, or, that kind of thing. I mean, I very quickly found out when I started writing that, you know, I need more material.
But at the same time, were you at all concerned about getting bogged down with the details?
Yeah, there are so many. There's so much detail in those regimental war diaries. I mean, there's daily weather reports. There's every order ever given. There's, you know, who was AWOL and how they were punished and I mean, just every. I mean, everything you could possibly imagine there'd be a record of is in there. So that took some time to sift through. It took months to go through. I mean, my book only covers from March of 43 to the middle of July 44, and it took me months to go through all those records, especially in the lead up to the invasion. The amount of detail is just overwhelming. So you've got to kind of keep an eye out for what you need. And fortunately for me, I mean, my book always had a very tight focus, and that I was writing about my grandfather and his friend and not some broader book about the Second World War. So when I was doing my research, it was easy to just remember, you know, I'm looking for these specific things that are specific to their experience. And I mean, you'd come across a million other things that were really interesting historical details, but that you would know, you know, probably wasn't going to make it into the book.
What was the impetus to doing this project?
My grandfather died in 97, and then, you know, after that, my grandmother hung on for a couple of years, and when she, it wasn't when she died, but she went to live in a nursing home for a little while, and so we had to clean her house all out and all that kind of stuff, and that's when I came across my grandfather's diary, and there's some other stuff I have, scrapbooks full of paperwork and stuff like that. And I have his medals, and I have his helmet and that kind of stuff. And it just, over the years, it has occurred to me that I've got all this great stuff. I mean, I've got a mini Canadian War Museum here in the house. and I just thought, you know, I should do something with it. Like, you know, I'm not one of these everything happens for a reason people, but it just occurred to me that, you know, maybe that stuff all came to me for the purpose of, you know, of doing something like this, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, it took me a few years to kind of have the balls to do it. I mean, you know, my grandfather was a very private man, and he would hate this idea. I mean, you know, if he were alive, I just would not be doing it. And there was also the fact that I wanted to wait until I was at the top of my game to do something like this, because the worst thing would be to do it and to screw it up. Northwest Passage opened a lot of doors, and there was a lot of people, you know, interested in you know, publishing whatever I was going to do next, and so I took that opportunity to do this project, which is, you know, close to my heart, and which I'd been thinking about for a few years.
So, In your experience, there's this whole myth that I've been hearing all my life that Canadians are not interested in their own history. Do you think that's true, or is that changing?
Yeah, I don't know if it maybe was true, but it does seem to be changing. I mean, like I say, Chester Brown's Louis Riel book and my stuff and Jeff Lemire's books and there's all Canadian history, or at least Canadiana seems to be a thing now, where it certainly never was before. So yeah, if it was ever true, it seems to be changing, like I say.
Who's going to be publishing the stories?
Two generals? The
publishing for Two Generals is a little up in the air. The original publisher, which was a children's publisher, they balked a little bit when I turned in the script. I thought they'd be interested in it sort of for the educational value, but it turned out to be something different than what they obviously thought it was going to be. So mm-hmm. I'm talking to a few people about Two Generals right now. It'll definitely land somewhere. There are three or four publishers who are definitely interested, so
I'm looking forward to it.
See, there you go. Yeah, I'm basically just going to pick my favorite, you know, which is a nice position to be in.
Yeah, that's great. I'm really fascinated by this kind of turn of people doing kind of the next step in autobiographical work, because David Heatley, he has in his book that's coming out in the fall, he's doing stories about his ancestors, like his grandparents and stuff. Yeah. Colin is doing his own work on his father's military service history.
I'm doing a story about my father's service in the Cold War.
So slightly less bloody than Normandy. Yes.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. It's an interesting trend. I hope it continues. There's a lot of really cool material.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I gotta give credit to Chester Brown for getting there first, but I'm sort of happy to have been part of the sort of first wave of people who planted a flag and said, you know, look, there's material over here.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I think Art Spiegelman beat everyone to the punch.
Well, true. Yeah. I'm talking in terms of like Canadian.
Oh yeah.
Canadian topics, though.
No, it's a good time to be Canadian.
And it is indeed. Any time's a good time to be Canadian.
Sponsored by Molson Genuine Draft.
So, Robin, do you think this episode has been more Canadian than the David Collier interview?
I think it's been a separate type of Canadian. This Canadian time, we didn't have canoeing. So,
we got a couple minutes. Can't we talk about canoeing?
Well, we're in Ontario, are ya?
I am in Waterloo, which is about an hour southwest of Toronto.
Okay.
And do you canoe?
I am an avid canoeist.
Ah.
It's true.
You'll have to meet up with David Collier. I mean,
maybe him and I can do a trip.
Not far. He's in Hamilton.
You could follow Mackenzie's route across Canada to the Pacific.
I'm going to put the canoe on the car, and me and David Collier are going to do that.
There we go.
We'll document it for your show.
I expect detailed analysis of this trip.
I want a graphic novel from each of you on the trip. Have you ever done autobiographical? Because I know a lot of people who are interested in history are also interested in autobiography.
You know, I have absolutely no desire to do any autobiographical stuff at all. I have to say.
And that's okay.
Yeah. I enjoy some autobiographical comics, but my life's not that interesting, frankly.
My autobiographical comic would be a classroom. Nothing but a classroom. Look, Robin's going to school.
There's a lot of me in Northwest Passage. I'm a father, and there's a lot of stuff in there about, you know, being a father and being a son. And I mean, you know, I put a lot of myself into my fictional stories that I almost feel like, you know, it would be, you know, a little too on the nose to just have a book about a character named Scott Chandler who is a cartoonist, and you know what I mean? It doesn't appeal to me, you know?
Okay.
Colin's all disappointed now. Aww. Thank you so much for joining us today, Scott.
You're welcome, guys. This was great.
It's been a swell hour, and I look forward to future Canadiana projects.
Right on. Thanks, man.
Okay. Talk to you later.
Bye-bye.
See ya.
Bye. Ink Studs, we're done for the hour. That was Scott Chandler. Check out his book, Northwest Passage, from Oni Press. Those fine boys at Oni. And it's a swell book. And he's got a bunch of other stuff. But the one we talked about today was Northwest Passage. Yeah. Crimes and Treasons up next. Back to y'all later.